WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Chris Albertson, has written a new edition of his 1972 biography of Bessie Smith, which was considered the definitive biography when it was published. Albertson first heard Bessie Smith on the radio when he was a teenager growing up in Copenhagen. Her music led him to a lifelong passion for blues and jazz. In 1970, he moved to the United States to pursue his interest in the music. Albertson convinced Columbia Records to reissue Bessie Smith's recordings, which they owned. He produced the reissues and wrote the liner notes. He won a Grammy Award in 1971. The reissue's success led to his biography of Smith. Albertson has also been a longtime contributor to many magazines and has written extensive liner notes for jazz and blues albums. He's produced many recordings as well as radio and TV programs. Let's start with this 1933 Bessie Smith recording, Do Your Duty. Bessie Smith died in 1937. The story of her death has become one of the legends of music history. But when Chris Albertson was writing his biography of Smith, he learned the legend was just that. It wasn't what really happened. Here's the story the way it used to be told.
The story was that she was in a car accident, and that part of it was correct. But then the story went on to say that she was taken to a hospital in Memphis. That was wrong because it wasn't Memphis. It was Clarksdale, Mississippi. And that hospital, being a white hospital, had turned her away because she was black, because that was the policy down there. And as a consequence of that, Bessie Smith allegedly bled to death. So she was a victim of racism.
How did you find out that this story wasn't actually true?
Well, I was suspicious to begin with because of the fact that there was a black hospital within a half a mile of the white one, so it didn't make any sense that she would be taken there. So that started it. Then I looked through old Downbeats, as a matter of fact, and I came across a story by George Hafer, who was trying to find out what really happened. He obviously didn't believe what happened. And he mentioned a doctor, Hugh Smith, who had been on the scene of the accident and was an intern at the Campbell Clinic in Memphis. And it turned out that Dr. Smith was still there. He was now the head of the clinic. And so I mentioned to him that I was trying to get to the truth of the death of Bessie Smith. He said, oh, I don't want to talk about that. I'm so sick and tired of all these stories, and they're all lies, and I've just decided I'm not going to talk about it. And he said, I'll tell you one thing. Columbia has just put out some new LPs on Bessie Smith, and you read the liner notes there, and you'll find the closest to the truth. And I said, well, I wrote those liner notes. He said, I'll talk to you. And he really did. He had a tape recorder at home, so he sat down that following Sunday. I had sent him some questions, and he just sat down and told in great detail what he remembered from the accident.
Would you sum that up for us, what he remembered?
Sure. What really happened was Bessie was driving her old, she wasn't driving, she was riding in it, and her lover, who was also her manager, Lionel Hampton's uncle, was driving the car. And it was just the two of them going on Route 61, a very, very dark, very straight road, mesmerizingly straight, as the doctor put it. And there was a large truck that from Nabisco, and the driver of that truck thought something was wrong with one of his tires. He had stopped the truck. He pulled over a little bit to the side of the road and went to check the tire and found out nothing was wrong. And he had gotten back into the truck. And in those days, those trucks accelerated very slowly. So as he was driving, off and continuing his journey, Bessie's car came, and Richard Morgan, who was driving it, suddenly realized, apparently, that he was going to hit this truck. So he veered to the left to avoid it. Bessie had her arm out the window, which was normal in those days. They didn't have air conditioning in the cars. And Bessie's arm apparently hit the back of the truck as it veered, turned over Bessie's car, and Bessie was thrown out. And so she was lying in the middle of the road. And the truck driver didn't stop to check it out. He just kept right going. So moments after that, while the taillights of the truck are still visible, this Dr. Smith, the intern from the Campbell Clinic, is going on a fishing trip with a Mr. Broughton, who is a friend of his. And they come across the accident. They see, all of a sudden, they see Bessie lying there in the middle of the road in his headlights. And they see the red lights of the truck disappearing into the darkness. And Richard Morgan running around totally dazed and hysterical. So he is being a doctor. He goes right over and checks Bessie. And she's not conscious, but she was bleeding, apparently bleeding internally. But her arm was almost severed. And so he sends Mr. Broughton to a nearby house to call an ambulance, and which Mr. Broughton does. But when he comes back and they wait and there's still no ambulance, they finally decide to move the fishing gear from the back of the car and put Bessie there. But while they're doing that, another car comes from the same direction, and it turns out to be a young white couple who had been partying and a little bit high and didn't see the doctor's car, and smashed right into the doctor's car, pushed that against the wreck of Bessie's car. Then suddenly, shortly after that, two ambulances show up, one from the white hospital, one from the black. It turns out that Broughton, of course, knew that Bessie was black, so he had called a black hospital. But the truck driver had gone right to a hospital, gone to the white hospital. I said, there's an accident up the road. He didn't know whether the people were black or white, so he just went to the white hospital. So therefore, these two ambulances came, and the black one took Bessie, and the white one took the couple. And that was it.
And Bessie Smith died of blood loss?
Bessie Smith, when she got to the hospital, the doctor had to sever her arm. And he said she never regained consciousness. She was bleeding internally, and she died at 10 o'clock that morning.
Let's talk a little bit about Bessie Smith's life. She was born in Chattanooga, grew up in a little shack. Her father was a laborer and a preacher. When she got a little older, she started on the black vaudeville circuit. Would you describe the circuit that she started on?
Well, she really started with a sort of a small touring company that would come and appear in little storefront theaters, you know, nothing fancy. And her brother, Clarence, her older brother, had gone away with a show, had left Chattanooga, and he came back with the show in 1912. And Bessie begged him to take her with him when he left. And so he arranged for an audition. But they didn't hire her as a singer. They hired her as a dancer. And it was the Moses Stokes Company. And it just so happened they'd had a singer already, and her name was Gertrude Rainey, and that was Ma Rainey. So there, another myth came about that, you know, that it was Ma Rainey who trained Bessie's voice, which was not true. I think Ma Rainey probably taught her stage presence. She might well have done that. They were very good friends.
So how did Bessie Smith make the transition from dancing in the same group that Ma Rainey was singing in to becoming a singer herself?
Well, because Bessie had been singing before she went on the show, before she left Chattanooga with the show where she was hired as a dancer. She had been singing on street corners in Chattanooga. So she was actually a singer, but the reason they hired her as a dancer is because they didn't need another singer. They had Ma Rainey, and they apparently didn't want two singers. So she became a dancer. And then, of course, as soon as she got an opportunity to sing in other shows, when she got to the 81 Theater in Atlanta, she started singing. And apparently anyone who heard her sing realized that that's what she should be doing.
Now, Bessie Smith not only sang blues songs, she sang a fair amount of Tin Pan Alley songs, songs like Alexander's Ragtime Band or There'll Be a Hot Time in the Old Town Tonight. How did she start singing that material as part of her repertoire?
I think she always did. I mean, I remember Ida Cox, the blues singer. I asked her about her when she started singing, and she said, well, the first song I sang was Put Your Arms Around Me, Honey. And Alberta Hunter, who was a great friend of mine, she started with Where the River Shannon Flows. And so they weren't really blues singers per se. They could sing anything. It didn't matter to them whether it was a blues or not. But then when the blues came into vogue after Mamie Smith's recording of Crazy Blues sold a lot of copies, then, of course, there was a concentration on the blues. But basically, most of the singers, you would not term them as blues singers. They were Tin Pan Alley singers who sang blues. So it was not difficult for someone like Bessie Smith to take After You've Gone or any of those Tin Pan Alley songs. And in later life, towards the end, in the beginning of the 30s, when she realized that the times were changing and tastes were changing, the blues had had their run, she started singing, and I'm so sorry we never saw any recordings of it, songs like Tea for Two and Smoke Gets in Your Eyes.
Wow, I would have liked to hear that.
Yes.
Well, let's hear one of the Tin Pan Alley songs she did record. Do you want to choose a favorite?
Well, I love After You've Gone. I think she does a wonderful job. Even when she does songs that are not blues, they almost sound like blues, the way she treats them. And I think After You've Gone is a good example of that.
Well, let's hear it. This is Bessie Smith. Bessie Smith recorded in 1927. We'll talk more with her biographer, Chris Albertson, after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Chris Albertson. He's just written a revised edition of his 1972 biography of Bessie Smith. Another new piece of Bessie Smith's biography that you presented in your biography of her is that Bessie Smith was bisexual. How did you learn that?
I learned that originally from Ruby Smith, Bessie's niece by marriage, who toured with her for 14 years. and told me all kinds of stories about what was going on backstage. And then, of course, I also spoke to Bessie's sister-in-law, Maud Smith, who was married to Clarence Smith, Bessie's brother, who was a comedian with the show and sort of a manager at one point. And she confirmed all that. And I've subsequently met some older Harlem residents who remembered Bessie as being a lesbian. But she wasn't really a lesbian. She just had a huge sexual appetite, and didn't matter to her it was male or female.
Bessie Smith's husband was Jack G. What was their marriage like?
Well, you heard the expression roller coaster. This was a roller coaster. You know, he was a very straight-laced guy. He was a night watchman in Philadelphia who liked to pretend that he had been a policeman, even had his picture taken in a sort of a policeman's uniform. And he never understood show business life. He met Bessie one night. He heard her at Horan's, and he liked her, and they finally got together. But when they married and he came on the road and he saw the way things went backstage and the sort of the hedonistic life they led, he was appalled by it. But he loved the money, and he saw the money coming in, so that justified everything. But he still never really went along with show business life. And so he didn't like all that, you know, drinking and partying. So when he was around, Bessie didn't drink. And like Ruby said, sometimes when he was around, if you mentioned something, a party you'd all been to or something in front of him, Bessie would shut you up because she didn't even want to talk about these things when he was there. But then the minute he left, and he used to go on these hunting trips, quote unquote, and he was always hunting. And then Bessie would let loose and have her various affairs and so forth. And the minute he showed up, and he always showed up sort of with a surprise. I mean, he never announced it in advance. He would just suddenly be there. And then the whole show was afraid of him because they would have a fight, and then they would calm down the next day, and then she would be all right until he left again.
What was Bessie Smith's image like on stage?
From all accounts, of course, I never saw her, unfortunately, but from all accounts, she was, there was something mesmerizing about her. She just had an enormous presence. And one thing that people always point out to me is that her movements, when she sang, were very subtle. You know, she'd raise an eyebrow, she'd shift a hip, just little bit, you know. They were never, for instance, I saw a Broadway show called Me and Bessie with Linda Hopkins, and everything was exaggerated. All the movements are exaggerated, but that's not how Bessie was. Bessie just was very, very, very sexy, they said.
You know, Bessie Smith is considered a blues singer, but on her recordings, it's not like she's being accompanied by Mississippi Delta bottleneck guitarists. She's mostly accompanied by jazz musicians, people like Fletcher Henderson's band and Louis Armstrong. Can you talk a little bit about that pairing of Bessie Smith and jazz musicians?
Well, it's because they didn't really distinguish that. I mean, it was black music. You know, black music was black music. When you appeared in vaudeville in these theaters, you had... They were jazz musicians. They weren't, you know, dance band musicians in the pit. So it was just a natural thing. Of course, Bessie did make some records with out-and-out dance band musicians. Terrible, terrible accompaniments, but she overcame them always. But she mostly was accompanied by jazz people. I mean, you know, Clarence Williams was considered a jazz person, but he wasn't much of a pianist. James P. Johnson, on the other hand, was one of the, you know, most fantastic pianists of that period and was the perfect accompaniment for her. But Bessie didn't always choose her, or in fact, she may never have chosen her accompaniment. I haven't found any evidence that she ever did, but Frank Walker did.
Her producer?
Yes.
How popular was Bessie Smith's music when she died?
Bessie Smith's music was not very popular when she died. This was 1937. There was swing music. So it wasn't about the blues. Still probably popular in the South, in the rural areas of the South. But basically not that popular. And Bessie knew it, and that's why she was changing her whole approach to the music and moving with the new trends.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
You're very welcome. I enjoyed it.
Chris Albertson, he's just written a revised and expanded edition of his 1972 biography of Bessie Smith. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.